This is Audible.
This is a copyrighted work. Unauthorized copying or distribution is a crime punishable by up to 5 years in prison and a fine of $250,000.
Scholastic Audio presents Grenade by Alan Gratz. Read by Todd Haberkorn and Andrew Iden. A note to the listener. This audiobook contains terminology that was used during World War II in order to accurately reflect the historical time period. Part 1. Hideki. The End. April 1st. 1945. An American bomb landed 100 meters away. Krakoom! And the school building exploded. Hideki Kaneshiro ducked and screamed with all the other boys as they were showered with rocks and splinters. Hideki couldn't believe it. 1 minute his school was there, the next it was gone. Worse, the bombs meant that the American battleships had found them. He turned to run.
Don't move! Nobody is to move!
Hideki froze. Every atom of his being told him to run, to find a cave somewhere to hide. But Lieutenant Colonel Sano's voice was so commanding, so forceful, that he didn't move. No one did. Even the governor of Okinawa, who was already 3 steps toward a shelter, stopped in his tracks.
Return to your ranks! Lieutenant Colonel Sano yelled.
Hideki inched back into line with the other boys and stood at attention, his heart pounding. Takashi, another fourth-year boy, whimpered softly beside him. Katsumasa, who was Takashi's best friend, stood ramrod straight, a bead of sweat rolling down his face.
"What's the matter, babies?"
Yoshio whispered from the row of students behind them.
"Ready to run home to mommy?"
Hideki's neck burned hot with shame for being scared. Yoshio was a fifth-year boy who had made it his personal mission to terrorize all the fourth-year boys, especially Hideki. Yoshio was half a head taller than Hideki, with arms as big as tree trunks and a face full of chickenpox scars that made him look twice as old. Hideki had always been the smallest boy in the school, and Yoshio had never let him forget it. Hideki was 14 years old but looked like he was 12, with a round boyish face, thin arms and legs, and short-cropped black hair. Hideki had to keep an ear open for whatever stunt Yoshio might pull behind him, but the rest of him was transfixed on what was happening in front of him. If he could have moved without being scolded, Hideki would have made a rectangle with his fingers like a photographer had shown him once, to frame a picture of what he was seeing. And what a picture it would have made. 100 boys stood in a small clearing outside what was left of their middle school. All of them wore their tan Imperial Japanese Army uniforms and caps. It was almost 2 o'clock in the morning, and it was dark. The ground shook with the heavy booms of artillery shells falling all around them, fired by American battleships offshore. A single flickering lamp cast an eerie, dreamlike glimmer on 2 rows of students standing on one side of the schoolyard, and a row of teachers on the other. In the middle stood their principal, Norio Kojima, alongside the governor of Okinawa and Lieutenant Colonel Sano of the Imperial Japanese Army. Hideki studied Sano, who stood rigid in his khaki uniform and knee-high leather boots. A sword hung from the lieutenant colonel's belt, and the breast of his jacket was crowded with colorful ribbons. Hideki knew that all the other boys were as spellbound by Sano as he was. Sano was the one they wanted to be. They were gathered here now, outside their bomb shelters, because tonight Hideki and his classmates were graduating early. The governor of Okinawa and a Japanese lieutenant colonel usually weren't in attendance at graduation, and the ceremony wasn't usually held at 2 o'clock in the morning. But then, it wasn't every day America invaded your island, either. Today was the end of everything Hideki had ever known.
"Later this morning, the enemy will land on Okinawa,"
Lieutenant Colonel Sano announced in his imposing voice as the bombs continued to fall.
American devils, whose only purpose is to kill you and your families in the most brutal, merciless ways possible.
Hideki shuddered, hoping that Sano and Yoshio wouldn't notice.
They will hunt your grandparents down and burn them alive, Sano continued. They will torture your mothers, butcher your brothers and sisters. They will try to trick you too, offer you food and kindness. But the food they carry is poisoned, and the hand that beckons you with friendship hides the one behind their back, holding a grenade. Krakoom!
Another bomb exploded nearby, destroying a tree that had stood for generations. But no one was going anywhere now. Sano had their attention. Hideki knew that America and Japan had been at war for almost 4 years, fighting each other all over the Pacific in places like the Solomon Islands, the Philippines, and Iwo Jima. Then, a year ago, the Imperial Japanese Army had arrived in force on Okinawa to dig defenses for the inevitable American invasion. Okinawa was a tiny island, just 110 kilometers long and 11 kilometers wide. It lay south of the Japanese mainland and had once been an independent kingdom with its own language and religion. But Japan had annexed Okinawa and made it a province back when Hideki's grandparents were children. And now, because Okinawa belonged to Japan, the American army was coming to attack.
From this moment, Sano went on, his voice heavy with importance, you have graduated from students to soldiers. You are now the Blood and Iron Student Corps. Each of you must be ready to die a glorious death in the name of the Emperor. This is your island. It is you who should be fighting for it, not the Imperial Japanese Army. You must fight like demons to protect your homeland. One plane for one battleship. One man for 10 of the enemy.
Another bomb exploded nearby, and Hideki cowered. He agreed with Sano. But if this ceremony went on too much longer, he would never get to trade his life for 10 American soldiers. An American battleship would kill him and all the rest of the students with one shot. Fearless as he was, Sano seemed to come to the same conclusion. He nodded, and one of his lieutenants went down the row and put 2 grenades into the hands of each middle schooler. Hideki glanced at Takashi and Katsumasa in disbelief. The IJA was giving them real grenades. Hideki accepted his 2 grenades. Each was cylindrical, like a drinking cup, and weighed about 1 pound. They were a little bigger than Hideki's hands and looked like pineapple-shaped lanterns painted shiny black.
What's this?
Yoshio asked, and Hideki turned to look. Yoshio had been given 2 grenades that were very different from Hideki's. Yoshio's grenades were made out of pottery.
The American naval blockade has made metal scarce, the lieutenant explained. Some of you will be given ceramic grenades.
Ceramic?
Yoshio said when the lieutenant moved down the line.
But if these crack, they're useless.
He glanced up, saw Hideki had been given 2 metal grenades, and quickly took them without asking, pushing his pottery grenades into Hideki's hands with a wolfish grin. Hideki wanted to complain, but he knew it was pointless, and would only make things worse with Yoshio. Hideki examined the glazed brown pottery grenades he'd been stuck with. They were the size and shape of baseballs, and much lighter than the real metal grenades. Inside the small rubber cap at the top, there was a match-like fuse and a little piece of rough wood. You activated the grenade by striking the fuse against the wood, but Hideki had no idea how fast the fuse burned and how long he would have before the grenade exploded. The complicated trigger distressed him, and the soft clink of the delicate pottery grenades against each other made him worried that they would crack, or worse, explode in his jacket pocket. But if these grenades work, Hideki thought, I can finally overcome my family's curse. I can prove to Lieutenant Colonel Sano and to Yoshio and to everyone that I really am brave, and I can make the Kaneshiro family fearless again.
One grenade is for the American monsters coming to kill your family, Sano told them, and Hideki looked up.
Sano's gaze swept down the row of boys until it stopped on Hideki, like he was talking to him alone.
Then, after you have killed as many Americans as you can, Sano added, you are to use the other grenade to kill yourself.
Ray. Operation Iceberg. April 1st, 1945. Private Ray Majors took a nervous peek over the side of the boat carrying him and his squad across the choppy waves toward Okinawa. Through the salty sea spray, he saw every American ship in the bay, more than 1,000 of them, shooting their guns at the island. Battleships, destroyers, cruisers, and overhead, wave after wave of planes flew over the island, dropping agony and death from above. All to protect the sitting duck GIs and Marines like Ray in their little boats. One of the battleship's big guns was so loud and so close that the boom rattled Ray's stomach. This was it. The real deal. The invasion of Okinawa, what the brass called Operation Iceberg, even though an iceberg wouldn't have survived 10 seconds in this blazing heat. It was Ray's first battle of the war, and it was a big one. It was all Ray could do not to pee his green pants. But he was almost relieved to finally be going into battle. For weeks, he and 200 other Marines had been holed up with 20 Sherman tanks in the dark belly of a rolling, creaking ship as Japanese suicide bombers came dropping out of the sky at them. As far as Ray was concerned, being trapped like a rat in the bottom of a ship was 10 times worse than being on deck and watching the kamikazes come in. But then, at last, had come H-hour, 8:30 a.m., April 1st, Easter Sunday, 1945. Codename Love Day. The day that Ray and the other 183,000 American soldiers and Marines of the 10th Army finally boarded amphibious troop carriers and headed east toward the beaches of Okinawa. The fact that Love Day was also April Fool's Day had not been lost on a single one of them. When he'd enlisted in the Marines a few months ago, Ray had never thought he'd end up on a boat 400 miles from Japan. He thought he'd be sent to Europe to fight Hitler and the Nazis, but Allied forces had just freed France and crossed the Rhine River into Germany, and the end of the war in Europe was near. Everybody could sense it. But the war against Japan was far from over. Almost 4 years ago, the Japanese had sneak-attacked Pearl Harbor, a U.S. naval base in the Hawaiian Islands. Ray remembered exactly where he was when he'd heard the news, sitting in a soda shop with Tibby Lundgren, her blonde hair shining in the bright afternoon sun. Their first date. His first ever date with anybody. The music on the radio had come to a sudden stop, and a reporter had read the shocking news. Battleships sunk, airplanes burning on the runway. Almost 2,500 Americans dead and 1,000 more wounded. Ray understood then that life as he knew it, the farm, high school, Tibby Lundgren, all of it was over. A day later, President Roosevelt declared war against Japan, and Ray ran away from home to join the Marines. They wouldn't take him, though. They made him wait until he was 18. Ray shifted uncomfortably on the metal bench, remembering the belt whipping his father had given him when he'd slunk back home. The acrid, sickly sweet smell of someone vomiting in the boat brought Ray back to the here and now. The rocking of the boat made Ray feel sick too, and he went through the equipment in his pack to distract himself. Flashlight, pistol, canteen, first aid kit, extra cartridges for his M1 rifle. The Marine issue entrenching tool, which as far as Ray could tell was just a shovel with a fancy name. And then there were the grenades, 2 of them, cast iron. Each one was about the size of a pear, but round in the middle and tapered at the top and bottom. The raised squares on them made them look like pineapples. Each was painted a drab olive green, the Army's favorite color, and had a bright yellow collar around the neck. To activate the grenade, you gripped the gray handle on the side and pulled a big wire ring attached to a pin. The grenade activated when you let go of the handle, igniting the fuse. Then you had just 4 or 5 seconds before it went boom. In another pocket, Ray found the brochure Naval Command had given him and all the other Marines to explain the difference between Okinawans and Japanese. Apparently there was a difference. The brochure said the Okinawans were generally smaller and were simple, polite, law-abiding, and peaceful. If they could help it, the Marines were supposed to pass Okinawan civilians on to the shelters being set up for their relief by the military government. But the brochure also warned that the Marines might get a chilly reception from Okinawans. "All they know about Americans, they get from Tokyo propaganda," it said. "So you can expect them to look at you as though you were a cross between Dracula and Frankenstein's monster. At first, anyway." The handout included some Japanese phrases to help draw the Okinawans from hiding, and Ray had been practicing them in the dark hold of the ship for the past 2 weeks. "Dete koi," he sounded out. "Come out." "Hidoi koto washimasen." "You will not be hurt." "Forget all that stuff," said Corporal John Barboza, who sat across from Ray. Big John, as everyone called him, was an enormous guy from the Bronx, New York, who'd probably been shaving since he was 5. Ray, with his close-cropped sandy brown hair, short legs, and round, freckled face, looked young enough to be Big John's son, even though Big John couldn't have been more than 5 years older than him. Big John was one of the few members of the 1st Marines to survive the division's last battle in the Philippines. He was also Ray's designated foxhole buddy.
"A Jap's a Jap, Majors," Big John told him. "You want my advice? Shoot them before they shoot you. That's how you survive." "Your last name is Majors?"
asked their squad leader, Sergeant Walter Meredith. The sergeant was tall and lean and tan, and had been with the 1st Marines even longer than Big John had.
"This kid needs a nickname, pronto. The enemy hears us calling him Majors, they'll think we're talking to a real Marine major and throw everything they've got at him."
Ray felt the blood drain from his face. How was that fair? He hadn't picked his last name.
"Where you from, kid?"
another Marine asked.
"Norfolk, Nebraska," Ray replied.
"Cornhusker, then?"
"No, Babyface. Kid looks like he's 13.
"Shorty,"
somebody else suggested.
"Let's wait and see if the kid survives the beach landing," Big John said. "Then we can worry about a nickname for him."
That shut everybody up, and they started thinking again about what was coming when they hit the beaches.
"They say it'll be even worse than Peleliu, and we got the holy crap kicked out of us there. I hear the Japs are waiting for us behind a 10-foot concrete wall with machine guns every 6 feet. I bet 80% of us don't make it off the beaches."
Ray's arms and legs felt weak, shaky, like at the end of a day working hard on the farm when he'd skipped lunch. Sergeant Meredith patted him on the knee.
"Don't worry, kid. Just keep your head down and move as fast as you can."
Ray nodded anxiously, and his oversized helmet slid down over his eyes. The boat's motor shifted down, and they could all hear it and feel it. They were slowing to run up on the beach.
"No, I'm not ready," Ray thought. "I'm not ready, I'm not..." "All right, Marines," Sergeant Meredith yelled. "This is it! Stay low, don't butch up, and run like hell."
The boat lurched to a stop, and suddenly the ramp at the front dropped into the water with a splash. Ray grabbed his rifle and ran like hell.
Hideki. The Divine Wind. Hideki had never seen so many ships in his entire life. He and other boys of the Blood and Iron Student Corps stood on a hillside overlooking the ocean. Below them were hundreds, maybe thousands, of American ships. Huge ones, too, bigger than any Japanese ship Hideki had ever seen in Naha Harbor. Hideki made a rectangle shape with his fingers and peered through it. When the Imperial Japanese Army had arrived on Okinawa, they had brought a photographer with them, Lieutenant Tanaka. His job was to take pictures of Okinawa so the generals could formulate their defense. Lieutenant Tanaka had told the school that he needed someone local, an Okinawan, to show him around the area and carry his camera equipment for him. Hideki had been given the job. Lieutenant Tanaka had lots of different cameras, some that used rolls of film and could be carried on a strap around the neck, others that clicked and whirred and took moving pictures. But the photographer's favorite was a beast of a camera that stretched out like an accordion and stood on a tripod. Because it was so big and heavy and took so long to set up, Lieutenant Tanaka would frame his shots through his fingers first. He showed Hideki how to do it too.
"What story does the picture tell?" Lieutenant Tanaka had said to Hideki. "That's what I'm always asking myself. Not just what's happening in the photograph I take, but what happened before it was taken, and what will happen afterward. How you frame a photo says everything about the story you're trying to tell."
Hideki framed a shot of the battleships at sea through his fingers. The story it told wasn't a good one for Okinawa.
"We'll never hold out against all those ships," he whispered to himself. "What's the matter, Hideki? Chicken?"
Hideki hadn't thought anyone could hear him, but of course Yoshio had. He punched Hideki in the shoulder, hard, making him flinch.
"Hideki thinks we're going to lose,"
Yoshio announced, and all the other boys laughed.
"No," Hideki protested, his face hot. "I just... The Yamato will be here soon, and it'll smash those American ships,"
Yoshio said. The Yamato was the biggest battleship ever constructed, and the pride of the Imperial Japanese Navy. If the Yamato did come, the Americans would have a real battle on their hands. But wherever the Yamato was, it wasn't here.
"Hey, I just realized," Yoshio said. "Hideki's never been through the gauntlet of fists."
Hideki blanched.
"No, not here, not now."
The gauntlet of fists was a tradition at his middle school, a brutal tradition. The fifth years would line up in two rows and send one fourth year running down the lane between them, punching him with their fists as he went. Fourth years who made it through the gauntlet came out bruised and bleeding. Those who didn't were sent to the nurse's station with broken arms and legs. Hideki thought that he had escaped his trip through the gauntlet, but Yoshio had other ideas. He grabbed Hideki by the arm and told the other fifth years to line up.
You can't, Hideki cried. "We're not in school anymore. There aren't any more fifth years and fourth years. We're all members of the Blood and Iron Student Corps." "What does that matter?" Yoshio said. "We're still bigger and older than you."
Hideki closed his eyes and braced for the first punch.
"Look!"
another fourth year cried.
"Kamikazes!"
Hideki opened his eyes and looked up. A squadron of Japanese planes had emerged from the clouds. Yoshio let go of Hideki, and together all the boys ran to the edge of the cliff to watch. The Japanese kamikazes waited until they were right on top of the American fleet, and then dive-bombed straight for the battleships. Kamikaze meant divine wind in Japanese. Hideki remembered learning about it in school. Hundreds of years ago, the Chinese Emperor Kublai Khan sent a huge armada of ships to attack the Japanese mainland. There was no way the Japanese could have defeated them, and it looked like China would conquer Japan forever. But then a vicious typhoon had risen up in the Sea of Japan. The storm wrecked most of the ships and scattered the rest, and Kublai Khan was defeated. The Japanese believed their emperor was divine, and that heaven had saved them. They called the typhoon the kamikaze, the divine wind, and they believed even now that Japan could never be conquered. Even if they were losing, at the last minute, a divine wind would come along and save them. Just like these kamikazes had saved Hideki here and now. Not quite willing to wait on the heavens to save them, the Imperial Japanese Army had organized a last-ditch divine wind of their own. Today's kamikazes were special attack planes that flew missions from Japanese air bases, never intending to return. They were loaded down with as many bombs and explosives as they could carry, and a kamikaze pilot's only mission was to crash his plane into an Allied ship in a suicide attack. Hideki's heart swelled at the sight of the planes dropping out of the sky into the withering anti-aircraft fire of the giant American ships. This was true bravery, he thought. To fight in the face of overwhelming odds. Not like him, cowering and hiding from Yoshio, hoping for a battle to spare him from a beating. Hideki thought about his cowardly ancestor, Shigetomo. Centuries ago, Shigetomo had surrendered without a fight when Japanese samurai had invaded Okinawa. His family had been spared, but the samurai cut off Shigetomo's head even though he hadn't fought back. On Okinawa, you lived under the same roof with the spirits of your ancestors. The shadow of that decision, the 350-year-old ghost of their cowardly forefather, had haunted Hideki's family for hundreds of years. It haunted Hideki still. One of the kamikazes twisted through the hail of tracer fire and dove straight into the tail of an American destroyer. It hit with a fierce explosion that boomed across the water, and fire and black smoke poured from the deck of the ship.
"Banzai!"
Hideki yelled with the other boys, and they danced and pumped their fists in the air. But then Hideki quieted. Deep down, he knew the truth. The kamikaze plane that had hit the destroyer was the only one that had gotten through. Dozens more kamikaze planes were being shot down by American ships long before they ever got close to the armada. Again and again, the kamikazes exploded into bright red balls of flame, and the pieces of their planes tumbled harmlessly to the sea. This was a battle the divine wind was not going to win. Soon, the other boys quieted down as well. When the 5th years tired of watching the kamikazes, Hideki knew they would turn on him again. Yoshio would turn on him again. Send him through the gauntlet of fists. He was sure of it. Unless Hideki could think of something else to distract them. Hideki couldn't see the beach where the American transports were landing, but it had to be close. He pulled one of the grenades from his jacket pocket and hefted it with bravado.
"The army probably has something special planned for the American monsters when they hit the beaches," Hideki cried. "But let's go kill the ones who get through."
Hideki's classmates cheered again, and he sighed with relief as they ran off ahead of him into the forest. Anything was better than facing the gauntlet of fists, even American guns.
Ray. Love Day. Blood pounded in Ray's ears as he staggered into the waist-high surf, his heart beating 1,000 times a second. His helmet slid down over his eyes again, and he struggled to push it up. He plunged headlong through the waves and tried to keep his rifle out of the water. The pack on his back felt like it weighed 10 tons and was going to drag him down with it. "Stay low, don't bunch up, and run like hell," he repeated to himself. He high-stepped the waves when he could, separating himself from the other Marines so they wouldn't make such easy targets. He crouched low, his whole body clenched in anticipation of the machine gun fire, which never came. Only after he'd scrambled over the broken remains of a seawall and lurched up onto the beach did Ray realize there was nobody to shoot, and nobody shooting at him. Besides the giant craters left by the Navy's artillery, it was just a white sandy beach with low, rolling green hills beyond. No 10-foot seawall, no mines, no barbed wire, no machine gun nests. Nothing. "There's got to be some mistake," thought Ray. Where were all the bodies, the wrecked vehicles, the machine guns and mortars everyone had promised would blow him apart? One of the Sherman tanks, fitted out with pontoons to help it through the surf, clanked to a stop nearby. The tank commander popped up from the top hatch to see it with his own 2 eyes. He tipped his helmet back and scratched his head, clearly as perplexed as Ray and everyone else. Out at sea, Japanese kamikazes were buzzing the American and British battleships like flies, but here on the island, the Japanese army wasn't putting up any resistance at all. The rest of Ray's company splashed up around him. "Where are the Japs?" someone asked.
"Looks like they've taken a powder," said one of the new guys.
"Man, this is almost scarier than being shot at," Big John said. He propped his big Browning automatic rifle on his shoulder. The Browning, what the others called a bar, was so heavy it came with its own bipod to rest the barrel on, but Big John was so strong he carried it the way Ray carried his much lighter rifle. "Did the Navy barrage kill them all?" Ray asked. Big John shook his head.
"That seawall we walked over? Yeah. But there weren't nobody defending it,
or there'd be bodies all over the place. Man, I've been on vacation tougher than this, another Marine said with a laugh. Stay alert and don't get cocky, Sergeant Meredith said, cutting through the chatter. You don't want to die laughing. That shut them all up. Up and down the beach, sergeants and lieutenants pulled squads and companies together out of the chaos. Ray and Big John and the sergeant were a part of Easy Company, the nickname for Company E. Ray's squad came together and they tiptoed their way up to the top of the dunes at the edge of the beach. There was nothing beyond that except for a patchwork of farms as far as the eye could see.
Looks like you're getting that nickname after all, kid, Big John said, and Ray smiled in spite of himself.
What was supposed to have been a meat grinder had been a cakewalk instead. His pack was suddenly light as air, and he felt like he could march for days.
Well, heck, I already lived longer than I thought I would, so I'm happy, said Private First Class Billy Lineker, a red-headed 19-year-old from Fort Mill, South Carolina.
Everybody called him Hard Luck Lineker because he'd been shot in the butt at Peleliu and recovered just in time to get himself sent to Okinawa.
I never heard of this Okinawa place until a couple of weeks ago, said Private Francisco Gonzalez.
He hailed from Visalia, California, and though he wasn't as big and burly as Big John, he was the squad's other bar gunner. Like Ray, he was a new recruit.
Why we even want it? We've been playing leapfrog through the Pacific, explained Corporal Travis Starks.
Everybody called Starks the old man because he was 24 and married with twin daughters back home in Lee's Summit, Missouri.
Island to island to island. This is the last rock before the jump to Japan. We take Okinawa, and its next stop, Tokyo. This is Japan, technically speaking, said Sergeant Meredith. Even though it's its own island with its own people, it's still a prefecture of Japan, like one of our states back home, and don't think the Japs are going to give it up without a fight.
Everyone nodded, and Ray's pack started to feel a little heavier.
All right, we got to hump half a click east by nightfall to secure the area around the landing beach, Sergeant Meredith said.
Ray knew that this meant they had to march east with all their gear for half a kilometer.
Half a click by nightfall? The old man said. That's crazy. If Okinawa is anything like Peleliu, there'll be caves full of Japanese soldiers all over the place. We won't get 100 yards before we're pinned down. Our orders are half a click by nightfall, so we make it half a click by nightfall, Sergeant Meredith said firmly. He showed them a map of the immediate area.
Easy Company will spread out here, along this road, heading east. The rest of the 1st Marines will hump it north above us, and the Army's 96th Division will flank us on the right, and then make a hard right turn south. Time's a-wasting. Let's move out.
Ray's squad got walking down a dirt road through some of the prettiest countryside he'd ever seen. Neat little fields grew rice and beans and sweet potatoes and sugarcane. Thatch-roofed farmhouses sat nestled among forests of pine and bamboo, and some kind of strange tree that Ray had never seen before. It had a dozen trunks instead of one, and a big round canopy on top with vines growing straight down like the stingers on a jellyfish. In the distance, the farms rolled up into bright green hills and mountains. All in all, it could have been paradise if they hadn't been there to fight the Japanese, but there was something else wrong with it too. And finally Ray put his finger on it. There weren't any people. Yes, he could see other rifle squads from Easy Company to the left and right, working their way cautiously through fields and forests. But there wasn't a single Okinawan around. Where had they all gone? Had they all been evacuated by the Japanese?
Hey, look here!
Hard Luck Lineker cried, breaking the silence. They were passing by another farm, and he pointed,
a pig!
Sure enough, whoever had worked this farm had gone so quickly they'd left behind what looked like a year-old pig. Ray's squad collected at the fence to its pen to watch it snuffling around in the muck.
Man, I ain't had a good pork chop in ages, Big John moaned.
We ought to kill it and cook it up, said Gonzalez.
They all looked to the sergeant, expecting a no, but he was licking his lips.
I'm right there with you, boys. But I'm a plumber, I don't know nothing about slaughtering any pig. Anybody else?
They all shook their heads except for Ray. A horrible moment from a few years ago on the farm flashed through his mind, and he looked away trying to forget. Slaughtering this pig would bring up a lot of bad memories for him, but the boys wanted it so bad, and Ray was so eager to earn their friendship.
"I do," Ray said at last. "We used to do it every year back on the farm."
His squad mate's eyes went wide, and suddenly Ray was the most popular guy on all of Okinawa.
"What do you say, Sergeant? Can we do it?"
Sergeant Meredith thought on it.
"Well, we're already way ahead of schedule, and I'd sure like me some ribs."
The other men of Ray's squad hooted and hollered and slapped him and the sergeant on their backs.
All right," Sergeant Meredith said. "Don't make too much noise about it, or the other squads will hear and want a taste."
Hard Luck climbed up on the fence to go over into the pen after the pig.
Pack!
Something popped in the distance, and suddenly Hard Luck Lineker looked confused. His head dropped to his chest, where a dark liquid was spreading across the front of his uniform. He wobbled and fell over forward. Ray didn't understand what was going on until Big John tackled him.
"Get down! Get down!"
Sergeant Meredith cried.
"Sniper!"
Hideki. Blood and iron.
Thoom.
Hideki flinched, but he didn't run. He sat in the safety of a cave, watching through its entrance as American shells exploded over the next hill. He could feel the vibrations deep inside the island's bedrock. Hideki and the other boys had made their way down to the beaches, intending to seek out the Americans. But the constant shelling from the ships in the harbor had driven them away, and they'd sought shelter inside one of Okinawa's many natural caves. The rest of the boys were deeper inside, talking and laughing. Hideki would have joined them, but Yoshio was there, and had always paid to stay as far away from Yoshio as possible, even if that meant being closer to the American bombs. Hideki sucked on a piece of kanpan, a tough dried biscuit. He hated to already eat what little food the army had given him, but he was hungry. And besides, the Imperial Japanese Army was going to drive the Americans from the island in a matter of days, weren't they? If everything went the way the IJA promised, the battle would be over soon. Then Hideki's mother and brother would come home from Japan, and his father and sister would come home from the front lines. The whole family would be together again. It had been almost 8 months since his mother and little brother Isamu went away, since Hideki too was supposed to go away. He still remembered that day as though he had a picture of it. The hot August sun, the narrow docks, the throngs of Okinawans pressing toward the big black passenger ships waiting to take them north to mainland Japan. Hideki's mother carried Isamu in her arms, and Isamu clutched his little papier-mâché lion dog. Hideki followed behind with his father and his older sister, Kimiko.
"You'll be safe in Japan. Yes, much safer than on Okinawa," Hideki's father said, as though he was trying to convince himself, too. Oto was short, like Hideki, but stocky with a mustache and a trim black beard. He stood next to Hideki's sister, who was already taller than both their mother and father. Kimiko was thin and elegant, with a white streak in her long black hair that had marked her since she was little as a Yuta, a person who could see and speak to the dead. Oto and Kimiko were there to say goodbye, not go with them. Oto had already been drafted into the IJA to fight, and Kimiko had been taken from her school and pressed into service as a nurse in an army hospital. Hideki hugged his sister and his father, his heart aching. His family had never been apart before. He hated to leave them, but he hurried to join his mother and little brother so Kimiko and his father couldn't see his tears. He was almost on board the ship when someone grabbed him roughly by the arm.
"Here, what's this?" demanded a scowling Japanese soldier.
He held Hideki back.
"Just where do you think you're going? How old are you?"
13, Hideki said, surprised. "Almost 14.
14 is old enough to fight," the soldier barked.
Kimiko stepped between them.
"You don't understand," she told the soldier. "Hideki's a scaredy cat. 350 years ago, one of our ancestors died like a coward. And now every third generation, the oldest boy is born afraid. This time around, it's Hideki. Until our ancestor's spirit finds peace, he's worthless in a fight.
Hideki's face burned red with embarrassment, but everything his sister said was true.
Superstitious Dojin,
the soldier muttered, and Hideki heard his father gasp. Dojin was a rude way of saying primitive natives. The soldier was basically calling them animals. Hideki's fists tightened around the sack of clothes he carried. He was a coward. But it wasn't his fault. He was just born that way. And no amount of ceremonies and offerings to his ancestor had been able to free him from it. Maybe, he thought, it was time to try a more direct approach. Maybe it was time to override his ancestor's cowardice with his own bravery. Hideki stood tall.
I'm going to stay, he announced.
His father and sister protested, but there was no time, and they couldn't make him go. His mother and little brother were swept up the ramp by the surging crowds, and Hideki waved goodbye to them. The Japanese soldier nodded his approval at Hideki and went to harass someone else. Kimiko smacked Hideki on the back of his head.
Idiot, she told him.
Kimiko's rebuke echoed in Hideki's mind now as the shelling from the American battleships abruptly stopped. The silence was startling. There could only be one reason the Americans weren't shooting anymore, Hideki realized, because they were afraid of hitting their own soldiers. That meant there had to be Americans close by. The bushes outside the cave rustled, and Hideki's breath caught in his throat. He pulled one of his ceramic grenades from his jacket pocket and removed the rubber cap. He wished he had one of the real grenades, the kind where you just pulled a safety pin to activate it. He held the striking cap close to the fuse, his hands shaking.
Who goes there?
Hideki called, trying his best to hide the fear in his voice. People emerged from the bushes, and Hideki relaxed. It was an Okinawan family, an old woman, a mother with a baby in her arms, and a girl much younger than Hideki who clung to her mother's dress.
You must let us in, please, the mother said, trying to keep her voice down. There are Americans all around us. We can't let them capture us.
She pulled her children closer. The old woman's face was streaked with tears.
Come on in, then. Hurry,
Hideki told them. Yoshio and some of the other boys had noticed that the bombing had stopped, and they came to the mouth of the cave to see what was happening. As soon as he saw the Okinawan family trying to come inside, Yoshio blocked their way.
Where do you think you're going? Yoshio said. You can't come in here. This is a military cave.
Hideki wanted to argue. Wasn't it the army's job to protect the people of Okinawa? But he didn't want Yoshio to turn on him again.
Go away,
Yoshio told the family.
Yes,
Hideki said, brandishing his grenade to show them he meant business.
This cave belongs to the Blood and Iron Student Corps. Go hide somewhere else.
A strange noise came from the other side of the hill. A motorized rumbling like the sound of a bus. The women and children heard it too, and they turned and ran away, screaming. Hideki's heart raced, and his stomach twisted. Was this it for real? Had some of the Americans gotten past the beach? Was he finally going to have to fight?
Hideki, go see what it is,
Yoshio said. He shoved Hideki with both hands, and Hideki stumbled outside into the harsh daylight. Be brave like the kamikazes, Hideki reminded himself. Grenade in one hand, rubber striking cap in the other, he took a deep breath and ducked into the bushes at the top of the hill. He crept forward until he could see over the ridge. The dirt path below him was lined with American vehicles, gray trucks filled with soldiers, enormous clanking green things with cannons on top and treads for wheels, open-topped jeeps pulling giant guns on trailers. There were scores of them. They kept coming around the bend in the road, and kept coming and coming. Hideki ducked deeper into the thicket, afraid they would see him. His hands shook. How was this possible? How had the American devils been able to get so many vehicles past the Japanese defenses? Hideki had seen more automobiles on that road in 5 minutes than there had been in all of Okinawa before the war. Hideki's shaking fear crystallized into a hard knot in his stomach, and he knew what he had to do. He had to take out one of those trucks with a grenade. This was his moment.
This was his fate. He stood up, fully exposed if any of the soldiers in the trucks had bothered to look up at him, and got ready to strike the match-like fuse on his grenade. For the Emperor, Hideki told himself. For Japan. For my family. Hands grabbed Hideki and pulled him back into the bushes before he could activate his grenade. Hideki turned around. It was Yoshio.
What are you doing? Hideki cried.
The Americans! They're close by, Yoshio told him.
I know! The road down there is full of them!
No, you fathead! Closer than that, Yoshio said. One of the boys heard somebody crashing through the forest, and we're all going to attack.
Ray. Pigs to the slaughter. Down, down, sniper! Starks yelled. Ray scrambled under the wooden fence that kept the pig inside. Peck! Another bullet hit right where he'd been lying 2 seconds ago. Ray flattened himself in the mud. There was a ridge underneath the fence that was just tall enough to hide behind, but no more. He held his helmet with both hands as the rest of his squad crawled under the fence and flopped into the muck beside him.
What about hard luck? Starks asked.
There was barely room for all five of them behind the little ridge.
Dead,
Sergeant Meredith answered. He unlatched the bayonet from his rifle, balanced his helmet on top of the bayonet, and slowly raised his rifle above the ridgeline. Pack! The sound of the sniper's rifle was quickly followed by the sound of the bullet hitting the helmet. Pang! Ray watched the helmet tumble toward the pig, who was still snuffling away on the other side of the pen. Ray saw the hole where the bullet had gone clean through the helmet. He swallowed hard.
Dang, that guy's good, Gonzalez said. Wait, shh, the sergeant said.
He waved them all quiet. And over the sound of the pig grunting, Ray heard a sound he recognized from his hunting days. Bolt action, Ray whispered. Sergeant Meredith nodded, and Ray felt a quick lick of pride, like he'd answered a question right in class.
He has to manually chamber a new round every time he fires, the sergeant said. That gives us a chance. You think you'd recognize that sound again?
He asked Ray. Ray nodded.
All right, Gonzalez, Big John, get those bars ready to go. Ray, next time that sniper shoots, I want you to get over that fence and run to that well on the other side of the road. We'll lay down cover fire for you. You hide there, and the next time you hear that bolt action, you chuck a grenade at it. Got it?
Run across an open road with a sniper out there? Ray's breath came quick. He felt lightheaded, but he nodded. He wriggled out of his pack, pushed his helmet down on his head again, and gripped his M1 rifle so hard his knuckles turned white. He would do it. He had to do it. This was what he'd signed on for, after all, why he'd left his home in Nebraska. He remembered how his father had argued with him, forbidden him to go.
You've got a deferment from the government, his father had shouted. You don't have to go, and we still need you on the farm. I gotta do my part before the war ends, Ray had told him.
There hadn't been a whipping this time. Ray was too old for that. It was hypocritical for his pa to protest anyway, and they both knew it. Ray's father had done the same thing when he was Ray's age, run off to join the Marines to fight in the Great War. And they both knew the real reason Ray had wanted to leave home. The long scar on his left arm peeking out from his shirt sleeve was all the reminder Ray needed.
Peck!
A bullet hit the mud with a thwack, a half an inch from Big John's boot.
Jumpin' Jehoshaphat!
Big John yelled, wiggling his legs up closer to him. But Ray was already leaping over the fence. His feet hit the ground with a thump, and he ran like blue blazes for the protection of the stone well across the road. The well had appeared closer before, but now it looked like it was half a mile away.
Stay low, run like hell.
Behind him, Gonzalez and Big John opened up with their big Browning automatics to create cover fire for Ray.
Chung, 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 chung.
The guns chewed the ferns and palm fronds along the bank into shreds. Ray stumbled but kept his feet, desperately trying to remember how long it had been since the last sniper shot. 3 seconds? 4? How long did it take him to chamber a new bullet after he'd taken a shot at a deer? Ray made it across the dirt road and threw himself at the base of the round well. The bars stopped firing. Ray's chest heaved, and he struggled to catch his breath. No time to rest, though. He dropped his rifle and fumbled for a grenade, his hands shaking. He wondered if the sniper had even seen him through all that cover fire. Pacow! A piece of the well's stone wall blew up in Ray's face and he ducked away. That answered that question. The sniper's rifle report was much louder now, much closer. Ray popped up, heart in his throat, and strained to listen for the sound of the rifle's bolt sliding back and forth. He was totally exposed standing there, and Gonzalez and Big John couldn't fire again to cover him, or he wouldn't be able to hear the sound of the bolt. Ch-chick! There. Ray picked a spot in the trees he thought the sound had come from, pulled the pin, and threw his grenade toward the green hillside. He dropped it down and grabbed his helmet to his head. Ka-thum! The hillside above him exploded, showering everything with dirt and rocks and plants. Hands in the air! Stay where you are! Sergeant Meredith yelled. Ray grabbed his rifle and peeked out from behind the well. The sniper had tumbled out of the ground cover on the hill and was just getting to his feet. Ray hadn't hit him, but he'd flushed him from hiding. Rifle raised, Ray got to his feet and ran at the Japanese soldier. Or was he Okinawan? He wasn't wearing a uniform and didn't have any other equipment. Dang, he's just a kid, the old man said as the others ran up. He was a kid, Ray realized. He was cowering and sniffling like he'd gotten in trouble. He couldn't have been more than 12 years old. Well, there's your first Jap, Big John told Ray. I think he's Okinawan, said Ray. If he was shooting at us, he's a Jap, Big John said. So, do we take him prisoner? Ray asked. I've got my Japanese phrase book. Sergeant Meredith shook his head. We can't take prisoners, kid. We have to keep moving. Ray didn't understand. But what about the support services for Okinawans? That's for refugees, the sergeant told him. He's an enemy combatant. You want to do the honors? Big John asked Ray. You flushed him out. Ray still didn't understand what was going on, and Sergeant Meredith shook his head at Big John. Big John shrugged, pulled out his pistol, and shot the boy. Ray almost jumped out of his boots, but only Gonzalez flinched with him. The others, the ones who'd been together at Peleliu and beyond, they didn't bat an eye. Big John put his pistol back in its holster and clapped Ray on the shoulder. Now, he said, let's take Hard Luck's body back and get you to cooking up that pig.
Hideki. Mabui. Hideki's hands were so sweaty he worried the grenade he held would slip right out of his grasp. He wiped a hand on his jacket and nodded to Katsumasa, who was a few yards to his left. All the boys were hiding behind whatever bushes and tree trunks hadn't been destroyed by the offshore bombardment. As a group, they crept forward, drawing closer to where they had heard someone crashing through the undergrowth. Hideki strained to catch every sound, every movement. Yoshio waved for everyone to stop, and then Hideki heard it. The crunch and snap of heavy footfalls on the forest floor. Someone was coming. The footsteps got louder, more urgent, and Hideki heard a man's breath. This is it, he thought. This is my moment of glory. But Hideki didn't feel glorious. His stomach was tied up in knots and he could barely breathe. He wasn't even sure he could stand. One of the boys jumped out from where he was hiding and yelled, Banzai! And more of them did the same. Hideki borrowed some of their courage and leaped to his feet, ready to strike the fuse on his grenade and throw it at an American soldier. But it wasn't an American soldier. Huffing along the trail was Norio Kojima,